The second case for our calendar is State of Minnesota versus Nicholas Gage Carr, case number A201183.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So very much looking forward to argument today. I assume both of you can hear me loud and clear. Okay, very good. And I'm sure you're familiar with the rules. They haven't changed. We are hearing this argument by Zoom, but the rules are the same as always. I'll give you a couple of quick reminders. Before you start your remarks, please identify yourself for the record, as well as the client you represent. We are recording today's proceedings, and those recordings are later sometimes helpful to us, as well as they are posted on our website. And then secondly, please keep an eye on the clock. It should be visible to you. And it tends to go quickly. We very much enjoy our conversation. So with that, we are ready to proceed. And the appellant can begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Amy Tripp Steiner, Assistant Minneapolis City Attorney, appearing on behalf of appellant, the State of Minnesota. The state respectfully requests this court to reverse and remand the district court's order suppressing the gun found in this case. The district court erred as a matter of law in finding that the officer improperly seized and searched respondent. The facts and law support a finding that respondent was not seized at the time the officer gestured to the squad car to offer a ride. And further, the facts and law support a finding that no search was conducted of respondent until after he admitted being in possession of a firearm. There are two issues before this court, the seizure analysis and the search analysis. Turning first to the seizure. The district court erred when it suppressed the pistol because respondent was not seized at the time the officer offered a ride to respondent. As this court is aware, a seizure occurs when we view the totality of the circumstances surrounding an incident from a reasonable person standard and determine whether that reasonable person would have believed he or she was neither free to disregard the police question nor free to terminate the encounter. And a seizure does not-
Steiner, may I just ask you one question preliminarily? I don't think you are challenging the district court's factual findings, but I'd like to know if you are in the beginning of this analysis.
There is a few things I think I may have noted in the brief. The district court made a finding that the respondent was not intoxicated, which is inconsistent with the officer's testimony and respondent's testimony himself that he was impaired at the time. For the most part, it is the state is challenging the legal analysis as it relates to the totality of the facts that were entered into the record.
Okay, thank you.
A seizure does not occur when a person does complies just due to some moral instinctive pressure to cooperate just because the other person's a police officer. And in Minnesota, we apply the Mendel-Rohr standard in reviewing those totality of the circumstances to determine whether a reasonable person would have believed they were seized. And some of those factors include if there's threatening presence of multiple officers, display of weapons, some type of physical touching of the citizen, or language or tone that compliance was compelled. So it really does require to look at everything that happened. And so this case is a little bit different than many of your seizure kind of cases in the sense that respondent was the one who initiated contact with Officer Williams seeking assistance. So on January 24th, 2020, about 3 a.m, very cold.
Mr. Tripp Steiner, I don't mean to interrupt, but I know your time's gonna go quickly and I think there's a lot of interesting things. We're familiar with those facts. My question is, as you list off those Mendenhall-Royer factors, is it your argument that you could have, say, one factor that would favor suppression or I should say favor a conclusion that there was a seizure and the other factors don't, and that you look at kind of the totality of those and you weigh and three say no when one says yes, so three beats more is more than one? Is that your argument or is it something else?
That's not my argument, Your Honor. From a state's perspective, and as the law requires, you have to look at each case individually and you're going to weigh finding in one of those areas may, without the other three, still may make it be a seizure because we're looking at the totality of the circumstances for that individual case based on a reasonable person standard. So we have to apply each fact to each case. I'm sorry,
I interrupted you. I think then in this case, the most pertinent aspects of those factors is indicating language or tone of voice, indicating that compliance with the officer's request might be compelled. And in this case, I don't think there was a question can I give you a ride? I don't think there was a question. I'd like to give you a ride, but if I do that, then I'm going to have to pat you down. Is that okay? The statement isn't that. And so maybe you can address why you think the language and tone in this case does not indicate that compliance could be compelled.
Yes, Your Honor. And the court is right. The officer didn't use that clear language of asking for a ride, but he did communicate through using a gesture. And we look at what had happened immediately before that gesture and the statement about before you get in, I'm gonna have to pat you down. And the whole encounter was about the officer giving the respondent assistance. There's no indication that he was looking for any type of criminal conduct. The conversational tone that can be heard for about 2.5 minutes during the encounter while the officer is helping to find that address, that same tone continues. So when the officer then says, all right, before you get in, there's no change there. It doesn't change into this, like, now I'm doing a criminal investigation. And so from a reasonable person's standpoint, what they would be seeing is that this, the state's arguing that it's just a continuing of the officer giving assistance, in that it followed immediately after about 2.5 minutes. And you can see on the video, the officer shows the screen of his cell phone to the respondent and confirms the location. And you see the officer put it, the clip on his belt, and then gestures over, respondent follows, and then the statement is made. And so from the state's perspective, that is not compelling the respondent to do something.
Is there any case you're aware of where the use of a gesture, I mean, the language, the case language uses the term language, right? It says the use of language or tone of voice. You don't really have tone of voice or use of language, I guess, in a gesture. So I guess what I'm asking is, are you aware of any other cases where the moment of seizure is at that point is communicated through a gesture?
I do not have specific case law on that issue. And it is true that the cases that the state has cited do talk about using language, you know, the offering of ride or whatnot. But when you're looking at whether the gesture coupled with, all right, before you get in, compels, is so compelling that it turns the situation into a seizure, based on the totality of the circumstances, that's not what a reasonable person would believe, that they are now being seized. And that's the state's position, is that, you know, because this type of situation isn't, like I mentioned, is not your typical type of seizure case. And we're talking about, at no point in time are, you know, up until after respondent admitted having a gun, there's no criminal investigation. The officer's acting in his capacity as a public servant. And so when he then gestures over, yes, Your Honor.
So Ms. Tripsteiner, let me follow up. You say a reasonable person wouldn't understand this to be a compelled, but the officer's language is, and I'm actually quoting as you got the language in, as you have the language in your brief, before you get in, I'm just going to pat you down quick to make sure you don't have any weapons on you. So that sounds like an order to me. I'm going to pat you down quick. So why is that? I'm trying to follow your reasoning. You're emphasizing the context that this started out as a helpful exchange, one initiated by Mr. Carr. And I appreciate that. That's clearly, that is the context of this exchange. But it shifts pretty quickly. And the officer's analysis, when he's asked about it, is that, well, he's just doing his standard operating procedure, which is, you know, if someone's going to get in the back seat of the squad car, he's going to pat, frisk them. And I understand why that's the standard procedure. That is certainly a reasonable procedure, but does it carry consequences under the Fourth Amendment, right? And at that point, if the order, you know, if the command or the comment, the language from the officer is going to direct, I'm going to pat frisk you, doesn't our case law say, okay, now we need either a warrant or an exception to the warrant requirement?
So as just so I make sure I'm following, because there's a little bit of a seizure and a search. Do you want me to analyze that under the seizure?
No, I'm not up there yet.
Okay, I'm sorry, I mean, Your Honor. I might have misunderstood.
No, I mean, if the officer's words are commanding a pat frisk, right? And you probably don't like me using that word command, but the officer does say, I am just going to pat you down, right? So he's saying, I'm going to do it. doesn't that trigger our analysis under Terry or something, right? Because at that moment, we have the officer directing a Pat's search. It doesn't matter that he doesn't initially conduct it. He's indicated he's going to do it. Isn't that the seizure?
The fact that's not quite the seizure from the state's perspective, Your Honor, in that it's that statement is all right before you get in. And that's coupled with that gesture of moving over to the squad car. And I know that I keep talking about the totality of circumstances of everything that happened prior to that, but that is relevant when we're looking at the reasonable person standard. And would a reasonable person who had just had 2.5 minutes of interaction with a helpful officer who gestures over to the squad car immediately after the officer locates that cell, locates that address, and then says, all right, before you get in, I'm going to pat you down. A reasonable person should feel free to be able to terminate the encounter at that time because there was no language that was indicating that he was being detained, no conduct that was indicating that he, you know, he hadn't handcuffed him. So the state's argument is that we have to look at the totality of everything that happened, and that saying, all right, before you get in, still gives that a reasonable person an opportunity to terminate that encounter.
And Ms. Tripsteiner, if I could follow up, because it might be useful in this situation to ask a hypothetical question to get at kind of the disconnect. There's a little bit of disconnect, I sense, between what Judge Bradfold's asking and your answers. Let's assume that instead of what happened, what you do have is you have Mr. Carr saying, excuse me, officer, I'm lost. Can you help me? And as the officer approaches, he says, yeah, I'll help you. But before I help you, I'm just going to pat you down a bit. That's the very beginning of the interaction. There's no other totality of circumstances, right? So if you remove totality of the circumstances that you, as you're talking about, does that create a seizure? The language used, I'm going to pat you down quick before I can before I can help you, I'm going to pat you down quick. It's just that language alone. Is that enough for a seizure?
In your particular fact scenario, that would be problematic. But we do have to look at the totality of the circumstances because that is what case law requires us to do. And if we looked at the totality of circumstances in your example, that would be problematic because the totality is they just get approached and then they're immediately seized that or in wanting to be pat before the officer would help. And that's different than what we have here. So the mere statement that he's going to pat him down before he gets into the vehicle, based on everything that had led up to that, does not equate to a reasonable person believing that they would be seized. And this is an individual, each case analyzed on its own facts. And the facts we have here is that Officer Williams was just truly trying to be helpful. And he testified to that as well, is that he thought the best course of action was to give the respondent a ride to get there safely. And he also testified that, yes, this was part of his practice to do that before someone got into the back of the squad car. But looking at everything that had happened here, that reasonable person standard is the one that we have to use. And it appears that the district court used the subjective belief of respondent, saying that he didn't feel like he could terminate the encounter. But as this court knows, that's not the appropriate standard. We have to use that reasonable person standard. Turning to the second issue of the search, the district court erred when it suppressed the pistol because respondent was not searched at the time the officer gestured to the squad car and indicated a pat search would be necessary prior to entering the squad car. In this case, the pistol was not located as a result of the pat search because it was respondent who actually was the one who indicated he had a firearm. When the statement was made, I need to pat you down real quick to check you for weapons, the officer hadn't touched respondent at all at that point. And then when respondent immediately admitted he did have a weapon, and then he still did not get pat searched at that time. The exchange happened, asked if it was a knife. Respondent then admitted that it was a gun. And it was at that point that—
So counsel, I think you skipped a spot, but help me out. I might have misinterpreted that. So after Mr. Carr says he has a weapon, as I understood it, the officer placed Mr. Carr's hands on his head. So there was touching at that point.
Yes, touching happened at that point, but he didn't like conduct a pat search at that time.
Yeah, I understand. But what about that as the point of seizure?
that could be very well the point that the seizure happens when the officer puts the hands on top of his head. And at that point, the officer has reason to believe that the respondent was armed at that time or had some type of weapon.
Well, weapon is what he said. Is that
weapon, correct?
That's so tell me, would you defend that as a Terry stop at that point?
At that time, yes, because then he has reasonable articulable suspicion that there is a weapon. And
the suspicion is of what offense?
I'm sorry, you cut out for a second.
Oh, okay. The suspicion, reasonable, articulable suspicion of what criminal activity? Because Mr. Carr has said, I have a weapon. So what is the, because I didn't see that articulated in the testimony given by the officer, but maybe I missed it.
His reason, because the officer did testify that his concern about having an impaired individual in the back of the squad car is that his, in his encounters, that they frequently carry knives and that that can be dangerous. May I finish my response? I see I'm out of time.
Yes, you may.
And so the seizure at that point is permissible because there is some type of weapon. The furthering of the question that happens, find out immediately thereafter that it's a firearm, then gives that reasonable trickle suspicion of the fact that he could be under the influence carrying a weapon or being carrying a pistol without a permit.
Are there any other questions from the panel members?
No.
Okay. And of course, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, I think we're ready to turn to respondent.
Thank you, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Coley Grashton, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Nicholas Gage Carr. We are asking that the court affirm the district court's decision that the district court properly suppressed the firearm in this matter. Based on the fact that there was never any reasonable suspicion for the officer to ask the questions or expand the scope of the initial encounter with Mr. Carr. And I think the reasonable suspicion standard or Terry standard applies throughout Mr. Carr's interaction with law enforcement here. Again, everyone's familiar with the facts here. This started out as a consensual, I just need an address. Mr. Carr never once asked for a ride. The officer never asked Mr. Carr if he needed a ride. In fact, when we talk about a reasonable person standard here, he approached the officer. I think it's reasonable for the officer acting as a public service to indicate some additional offer for help beyond what Mr. Carr initially approached him for, such as, you know, I can give you a ride. I'm just headed back to my area and I can drop you off on my way. I know you're not familiar with this area. That never happened. And if you look at all the cases, as I indicated in my brief, all the cases that talk about consent to get in the car, they all involve some meaningful option by the defendant. Mr. Carr never had that in this case. This went from obtaining the address, being on a map so he could orientate himself as to where the hotel was, to within seconds having an officer saying he was going to search him and gesturing to the car. Now, the gesture, I argue, is language. I think the common definition, the definition in the dictionaries, is language in its general sense is any form of communication, whether it be written, oral, or by gesture. Had the officer used some words to explain why he was gesturing to Mr. Carr to get in the back of the squad car, I think the state might have a valid argument where Mr. Carr would have some option to say, you know, I'm fine. I'll continue on my way. I'm familiar with how to navigate cities. He just never had the opportunity.
So I'd like to just clarify your argument because I'm not quite sure I'm following. At one point, Mr. Grashton, you said that you thought Terry applied throughout the interaction between the officer and Mr. Carr, but I don't hear your argument as saying that. It sounds like you're suggesting that there was a friendly public exchange of information, assistance to the officer initiated by Mr. Carr. I don't think Terry applies to that portion of their interaction, does it?
No, it does not.
No, and I don't think you're saying that. Okay, so, but we get to the gesture, and now I think you're arguing that at that point, something has changed. So would you help me out and tell me what you think has changed?
Well, that's really, you know, the start of the analysis as to where the character of this interaction between law enforcement and Mr. Carr changed. And whether a reasonable person, we would look to whether Mr. Carr was seized, whether a reasonable person would believe they were free to leave under those circumstances where it was friendly and a friendly communication. If the officer was merely trying to assist and be a public servant, I think it's reasonable that an officer would indicate his willingness to do so and whether Mr. Carr wanted his help or not, any further help. So that's really, when we get into that gesture, the fact that there is no communication for any options, there is no time for a meaningful option to decline, and we look to whether a reasonable person could decline that. I don't think any reasonable person could when you have a licensed peace officer in uniform, not just gesturing, come to my office so I can chat with you, you're free to leave, get in the back of the squad car. That is putting in the back.
Mr. Groshen, let me break it apart a little bit because I'm not sure exactly where you're saying the seizure happens. Are you saying that the gesture alone could be enough?
I am.
And what case finds that a seizure has occurred based on a gesture?
I'm looking to the Bostic case, that this is a show of authority by the officer. So a show of authority by the officer and whether a reasonable person would perceive that as a show of authority.
Does it depend on the nature of the gesture? Or can you have a gesture that's not showing authority?
Sure.
Is it about this gesture, that the nature of this gesture that you're saying creates the seizure or the show of authority?
The totality of the circumstances.
Not just the gesture. You're adding to the gesture some other thing, which is fine. That's why I wasn't sure what point. So in this case, are you saying that the gesture alone, the nature of it, was enough? And if so, what is it about the gesture that gets you there?
Well, it depends who's giving the gesture, I suppose.
I'm talking about in this case now.
Right.
But the gesture that was given in this case by the officer, what is it about the nature of that gesture that shows authority?
The fact that he's a licensed peace officer and the fact that he's directing him into the rear of a squad car, which is where people who are arrested are directed to and ordered to get into, sometimes by force. And I think when we look at that, a reasonable person wouldn't feel free that they could disengage from that encounter. Now, could a gesture, that's a difficult question to ask, but I think given the circumstances of law enforcement, had this officer continued with some type of language that would show this was some option, then we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But
it's not just the gesture, it's the absence of anything communicating an option or that this is a request.
Correct. And then almost immediately following that gesture, I'm going to search you. Nothing in that characterizes the interaction from the moment of the gesture to the communication of the intent to search that it was optional for Mr. Carr. That a reasonable person would perceive that as, I don't know why, but this has taken a turn for the worst. And I'm not sure what's happening, but I'm going to comply with this officer. They want to search me. That's what we have here. And I understand, I want to get on, although we have 7 minutes left, that there's an important part that I think the state argues, if I can move on, to whether there was a search or not, and whether this admission by Mr. Carr that he had a weapon, I think it is important to note that prior to the officer placing his hands on Mr. Carr, that there was no indication of what type of a weapon, whether it was a pocket knife, which would certainly be perfectly legal for him to keep in his pocket, as many people do, or whether it was a firearm. But in any event, when we look back at this, is I guess more when we get into Terry, when we look to the Terry case and other cases that follow Terry about the expansion of investigations in the scope of a traffic stop, again, we have no basis for the officer to initiate any type of search at this point in time. And by him merely asking him if he had a weapon, if the court finds that in fact communication that Mr. Carr was carrying a weapon formed some basis to search, that compulsion or that admission was coerced. And I think it's synonymous with asking somebody if they have weapons on them and during a traffic stop, or if there are drugs in the car at a traffic stop, when the initial basis for the traffic stop is a failing to obey a stop sign. There's each incremental expansion of this interaction between the public, officers have to have some basis to expand upon that. And that just really wasn't here. And, you know, if we look back to, I know the state characterizes the officer's actions, and the officer did too, as being a public service and trying to help out. But he did mention, and the state mentioned in their argument here, that he often finds that people who are intoxicated carry weapons. So there's, in the back of this officer's head, he indicates that he has some suspicion, although it's not reasonable suspicion. It's certainly a hunch under these circumstances. So there's some indication that maybe there was some pretextual actions by allowing him to do this under the pretense of being a public servant that he could search Mr. Carr. I'm not aware, unfortunately, there's not a lot of case law where in a case like this, where it turns into a search and a seizure after somebody asks for directions. Certainly the cases that are cited in the state's brief indicate, you know, there's a towing of a car or some other circumstance, but here it's certainly a unique case as far as I'm concerned. But in any event,
Let me ask you about a case that's similar. It's an Eighth Circuit case interpreting the Fourth Amendment. So it's not a state of Minnesota case interpreting the state constitution. But in that case, it's the United States v. Lozano. I don't know if you've read that one or not. I can give you a brief summary of the facts if you aren't familiar.
I'm not familiar.
Officers responding to a report of suspicious activity comes upon two kids. They begin some small talk about sports and whatnot, offers to give the kids a ride home. And before they accept, he says he has to pat search them. The kids don't protest that or indicate a desire to walk away, same as here. And during the pat search, the officers, I think, recover a weapon and charged with that. The Eighth Circuit holds that that's not a problem for the Fourth Amendment, that the search was consensual and that there's an objectively reasonable basis to do the search, which is officer safety. In other words, this standard policy of patting down passengers was recognized by the Eighth Circuit as not precluding then charging those passengers with a weapons offense if that's what's found. And so it does seem to suggest that you don't need reasonable suspicion to do a pat down search, that you can do one for purely officer safety reason.
I'm not familiar with that case as far, you know, certainly those individuals, it sounds like they had an option whether they wanted to comply. In regards to this policy that anytime an officer is placed or anytime a person is placed in a squad car that officers can pat search them, there's cases that say that flies in the face of Terry. And you can imagine a situation where if the courts would allow anybody placed in the squad car to be searched without any other basis, we would have a lot of people being put into squad cars to be searched. I'm not familiar with that case, but I think there's other case law that is contrary to that holding in that Eighth Circuit case. I have nothing more. I appreciate your time. We would ask again that the court affirm the district court's ruling, that court did not clearly err in their ruling and the evidence should be suppressed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll wait just a few minutes. There we go. We've got the 5 minutes set up. Ms. Tripp Steiner, you can begin your rebuttal when you're ready.
Thank you. Your Honor, the state is asking for this court to reverse the district court. And as was just discussed about that Eighth Circuit case about an officer being able to search somebody before putting them in the back of the squad car, we do have case law here in Minnesota that supports that there may be times when, based on officer department policy, that an individual can be searched prior to being put in the back of the squad car. And that was talked about in Lemert. And the analysis is to, as long as it's not a basis to do an improper search. And while respondents' counsel indicated that there may have been some kind of pretext based on Officer Williams's experience that individuals may have knives on them, it was asked in the context about why he would do that search in addition to his public the policy is because he didn't want the respondent to hurt himself being in the back of the squad car or potentially to hurt the officer. And so you're looking at, when we look at everything, the total context of what happened in this interaction, the officer asked, wanting to do this pat search quickly before putting him in the back of the squad was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, because that's the touchstone of what we look at in the Fourth Amendment analysis is reasonableness. And it was reasonable for the officer to offer the respondent a ride because of it was cold and all those things that he was alone, had no working cell phone, in an unfamiliar area. And then he testified he wanted to help the respondent get to the hotel safely. And there's no evidence in the record that he had any kind of pretext or was trying to do anything improper, but merely just to be rendering aid. And so based on everything that this court has before it, the state respectfully requests that this court reverse and remand the district court's order suppressing the gun and remand for further proceedings.
Ms. Tripp Steiner, are you asking us to articulate a rule that would permit pat searches in the absence of suspicion of criminal activity?
Your Honor, I don't think that a rule needs to be listed that way because we already have the exception listed in Lemert. That there are times that based on department policy alone, an officer can conduct that pat search. And if there is to be a rule, Your Honor, it should incorporate that the context matters and that you have to ensure that the officer is not doing it for an improper purpose. And but as it relates for this case,
Let me get back to Lemert because I'm a little troubled that you would want us to extend that because my recollection of that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, my recollection of that is that that's a case where there are some additional facts that would provide reasonable suspicion to do a pat search. It's not merely department policy. Whereas in this case, we really are potentially looking at something we have facts that are clearly not reasonable suspicion of criminal activity at the point of the gesture.
And you're correct, Your Honor, that Lemert did have additional information, but the state was referencing Lemert because of this fact that it brought up that department policy. And you're right, we do have something different here.
Okay, so let me get back to what I asked, right? Because we would then be extending Lemert a bit to a situation where you don't have, there's no one else with the defendant in our case who has just been arrested for something like in Lemert. So you don't have those elements of Lemert present here. Are you asking us to say that this department policy of doing a pat search of all passengers, that there's like almost a new exception to the Fourth Amendment for department policy reasons?
If this court were to do that, I mean, the state is not asking for it that clearly. The state is asking to find that it was reasonable based on the department policy and the totality of the circumstances. I think in Curtis, the court made clear that to search a person before placing them in a squad car is not merely an excuse for an improper search is an important part of that analysis. But if this court were to wish to extend that type of a rule, it would seem appropriate for this type of case scenario where the officer is purely acting as a public servant. They're not doing a criminal investigation. He was just trying to help out. And following department policy, which was to protect both the person who would be put in the squad car and the officer, would not be contrary to law. I see that I'm out of time. I thank this court and counsel for their time today and respectfully request that the order be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. The matter is well briefed and well argued. We now submit the case to this court for our decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe. So that completes the second argument on our oral argument calendar. Our third argument is scheduled for 11:10 this morning. And so this court will take just a brief recess while those lawyers come online. So thank you very much.